questions. If you have any questions generally about the sentencing guidelines, I'll try to answer them. This is what we're talking about basically, though, is as you might recall, these letters, Joe, I think counsel did a little blurb on this earlier. The guidelines basically set crimes based upon their crime seriousness, 1 through 11, 1 being the least serious, 11 being the most serious. And then the this axis, I guess the lateral axis, would be a criminal defendant with no priors, and this would be a criminal defendant with 3 or more person felonies, which would be the most serious type crimes. And then in sentencing, the judge would, you know, each, so in these rules, I should say, we've categorized each of the new crimes on this axis. And then when a defendant is found guilty, the parties either stipulate or there's a finding of what class crime it is, and then what the criminal history is of the defendant, and you find a box. And that is the presumptive sentence for that crime and that defendant in that case. And then once you find that presumptive sentence, to deviate from that up or down, the judge has to make findings of why they would do that, called mitigating or aggravating factors. Incidentally, this was the issue that I think counsel talked about with the case called Blakely. That's a United States Supreme Court case. Basically, what Blakely means is that those factors that you can depart from the presumptive sentence, Blakely stands for the theory or the fact that that has to be found by a jury based upon the United States Constitution's right to a jury trial. So that's the context, is we're talking about where to put crimes on here. Also, we're talking about whether to make a new crime or a substantially amended crime a person or non-person misdemeanor or felony. And again, that has to do with how that criminal history will be categorized for the future. So obviously, if you get convicted of a person felony rather than a non-person felony, it makes your criminal history look worse, basically. It looks like you have a worse record, for lack of a better word. So what I've given you is the bill itself. You've got my testimony, which kind of gives that background. And you've got the 2003 legislation that has affected the sentencing guidelines. I gave you that because I hope from that, if there's some bill you're interested in, I'll try to be able to tell you where it got classed. And then this is kind of the same type of thing where it goes by each bill, kind of what happened with it, and I'll try to answer those. So that's what Senate Bill 124 does. And then there's
one. If I could just interrupt you on this chart, if there's nothing over here in the far right column, then there will be no rule in this.
Correct.
Summary. Okay. Thank
Madam
you.
Chair, that's correct. Yeah, those are ones where the law change that was passed in 2003 was such that it did not require a change in the criminal seriousness or a change in whether it was a person or non-person. For example, let's see if I can find what I remember from last session. Say like Senate Bill 122. Mm-hmm. You probably don't remember that bill, but that was a bill. It was kind of a minor bill. It was a bill that said basically that you could rob someone and take property, including a vehicle, and you wouldn't have to prove that they had an intent to permanently deprive. I can't remember who. I was looking at Mr. Dubin because I think he might have testified on that. I can't remember. Anyway, that's an example where it was a minor change in that crime of Rob 3 to deal with a certain situation, but the commission looked at that and said, you know, this doesn't change the seriousness of that crime, so we're not going to change it. On the other hand, there's those cases where sometimes the legislature itself told the commission where to categorize a crime, and that would be more like the bill that we did last session that stated that for manslaughter and negligent homicide, it would be a category 9 rather than 8 if it was done with it by a drunk driver with a vehicle. So that one's in here, and that's an example of, you may recall, sometimes the legislature tells the commission what to do. But most of the time, and in most of the situations, the legislature leaves it to the commission to try to look at all the crimes, figure out what's the most similar, give this new crime in that same crime seriousness, and then this is me coming back to you saying, please adopt and ratify those. So I know it's hard to read this bill the way it is because it's just a bunch of OARs, but I hope that with what I've given you, and then here's a summary of the changes by how they appear in the bill. So I know that this is a lot of information. If you want to, you know, and want to take a look at it, I won't be hurt if you don't want to. If you'd like to take some time and look at this, and then Madam Chair, the other thing I wanted to point out is an important part that I shouldn't overlook, which is Section 2 and 3 of the bill. That deals with another issue completely, and I asked my good friends from the courts to be here, and they are Jeanne Ann Quinn and Nancy Miller here, so that you know that this is a, I think we are in agreement on this. The way that the commission gets its information from the courts is on a felony sentencing report. And unfortunately, what we're still doing is we're having a clerk fill these out by hand and then turn them into us. And we'd like to get beyond that and move into the computer age. And so Section 2 would allow that to be, you can see in page 2, line 29 and 30 of the bill, it allows the court to submit the sentencing information to the commission in accordance with rules. And that's to be allow the courts to submit that with the new UCJ. UCJ, which is the new way we're trying to get this data inputted in the computer, and then we can just harvest it off a server.
UCJ, Uniform Criminal Judgment?
Yes.
Just going for acronyms.
Yep. That's right. Uniform Criminal Judgment. I mean, this is gonna be a huge help. We've got stacks of these things we're trying to input. And it makes it so that our data is not as up to date as I'd like it to be. So that's what that part does. And then in Section 3 of the bill, on page 3, lines 23 through 26, it just says that we will adopt a rule on how to do this. And it'll mean that we will try to use the UCJ. And then, of course, the Chief Justice will have to approve that because we're basically asking the Judicial Department's really the one that's helping us with that, and I think it's great that we're moving this direction. So this would just allow that to be done. And that's really the bill. And I can attempt now to answer any questions on the rules, or you can do whatever you want. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess in light of the Blakeney decision, and obviously these rules were adopted before that.
Correct.
Correct. Would one potential fix of the Blakeney decision, because the way I recall our discussion about that earlier, is that a judge can deviate down without showing the cause or to a jury, but they can't aggregate the sentence. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator, I think you're right, and I think the way that a lawyer would articulate that is the state doesn't really have a jury right. So, you know, it's an individual's right to a jury trial, and that would be the defendant. Obviously, the defendant wouldn't mind going down, wouldn't mind the judge departing downward. So I think Blakely has been, the way I've looked at it, is only is going to affect aggravating factors.
So wouldn't one potential fix be to make every single crime in the upper left-hand corner of that box?
Yeah.
The presumptive sentence, and then let the judges deviate down if they so choose?
Senator Byer, we actually did discuss that in the Blakely work group, and the fiscal people sitting on the edge of the room
turned. They're still up on the ceiling.
Senator Prezanski is correct.
Okay, and I appreciate that, because obviously there would be a huge fiscal if the judges didn't deviate down.
Mm-hmm.
But as another potential fix, rather than to, and you guys have had a work group, but rather than to adopt these rules, to bump them all up a little bit and let the judges, so you don't have the enormous fiscal at the end, but you just, you know, you just bump them up a little bit through the statute now.
Senator Prezansky, did you want to comment on that?
I would just say, I mean, that's definitely a possibility. I mean, the other thing is you completely do away with sentencing guidelines and just go back to the traditional thing that says a Class A misdemeanor has a maximum, and have all of those, and then just, but you're going to lose the uniformity throughout the state, and that's why, one of the reasons that we went to this system, plus the cost driver of having people potentially going into a in-custody situation.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, you could definitely do that. I mean, it's
And Madam Chair and Senator Bayh, that's kind of what and we'll probably get into this again, but there's a case called State versus Dilts, and it's an Oregon case interpreting Blakely for an Oregon, you know, one of the Oregon defendants. And one of the theories, or one of the things DOJ said, is we call these guidelines, but they're mandatory that the judge follow the presumptive sentence or else put down the findings of why they're deviating. So I think guidelines is almost a misnomer now that we have Blakely. What the Dilts case said was, what another option would be to just make them, what's the word, permissive or
advisory.
Mm-hmm. And that was another one of the things that we discussed, but I think we had pretty much unanimity on really the best way for Oregon. This was the group that worked on it, and we're having, I think the fix is in at LC and it's not out yet, would be to actually just have after the trial and after there's been a finding of guilt and then you move into a sentencing phase, that we would just have the jury make the findings, so that then Blakely would be satisfied and we would keep what the legislature has put together as the way we do sentencing now in Oregon. So that's what I think is going to be drafted, but you're right. There's a lot of different ways you could react to Blakely.
And just as an aside, we will be seeing a bill coming soon to a Judiciary Committee near us. And it was the result of a consensus of a work group that included the DAs, the defense bar, the judges. It's a very, very good starting point for us to consider. Senator Prezansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Craig, my understanding of at least Section 1 SB 124 is really just more of a housekeeping based on what has been passed this last session, and you or your predecessor at the commission basically implementing what we said we want it done. And now it's time to just go ahead and put it in place.
Madam Chair, Senator Prezansky, that's true. I mean, most specifically true on the ones where, as I said, the legislature says, Commission, you shall do this as a level 6. But then there are the ones where we
have the discretion.
We have the discretion, and we try to figure out where to put it. So, I mean, yeah, there's nothing. It's pretty, you know, mundane, really.
One more clarifying question. I noticed on this one, on that handout, there's mm-hmm. some of them, like House Bill 2309, it says watch, and DOSA noted it says patient a danger. Do you want to say watch first? What does that mean?
I think I'm on the wrong page. Let me see.
This one, the one that has the House, the bill list.
Oh, I have the bill list. Let me see.
And kind of the catch guide, or I guess. But I figured out a misdemeanor must be a misdemeanor, but what's a watch? About 6 lines, that 7 lines?
Yeah, 141. Let me see if I can figure out what that is. I will admit that I grabbed that off of Phil Lemon's hard drive. That is...
That's his note to himself. Watch this bill.
No, I think that is... I'll check on that. I think that... if I can see it in context, I see it on 141. I can't remember what that bill was. So,
if you look on this sheet right here, you've got it appears on House Bill 2309
okay.
and 2379.
Yeah, I think these are just notes that Ms. Woman was
yeah.
using during the fight.
It might be.
Kind of be curious to know what that means myself.
Exactly. Let's
I'm
have
pretty
to
good
see
on
what
these
that,
acronyms, but that one.
But I think that means just what it says.
Watch it.
You know, because I'm looking at these sooner, Madam Chair and sooner, I don't know that. I think some of those didn't pass. I think I'm looking at this and saying, I don't remember 141 passing, so maybe Phil was watching that one.
Yeah, I looked at SB 655, watch for amendments. I mean, I think this was a work product that we probably just took and made a public record.
I think so. Sorry, Phil. If you're watching on TV, I apologize.
We need to subpoena Mr. Lemon.
Yes, exactly. I demand to know. No, you're right. Yes. Because I just thought it would be helpful if there's some bill that you all were curious about.
You will never live this down.
I know. I know. That and my bald spot shows up really big on TV, so.
Well, to clear things right out, Mr. Prinz, I think if it does not appear on this sheet,
you're right,
then it's not a bill that actually passed.
Right.
Is that correct?
I think that's right. And I'm sorry. I think I did give too much information, as you can see. But, I mean, you know.
It does look as though some of these do appear.
You're right. Those did not pass, and I apologize. So,
all right.
Sorry, Senator Byron.
We will put this in our bill folders, and they will become exempt from the public.
That's right. I'm going to make sure Phil didn't leave any other notes there. You guys are going to start looking at those pretty closely.
The shopping list or something like that.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions from the committee?
I promise not to shred those, too.
Thank you very much. Would the committee like for the courts, Nancy Miller, I see, is in the audience, for somebody from the courts to come and explain Section 2 and 3, or are you okay with that? Well, I was perfectly prepared to hold this over till Monday if people want to spend more time with this, but we could move it or hold it. What is the wish here? Want to unload this and never look at it again?
I mean, this is...
Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 124 and open a work session on Senate Bill 124.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 124 to the floor if they do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 124 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Byer, would you like to carry this? Senator Przasky is willing if you would.
It doesn't matter to me. I'll do it.
Thank you.
No attorneys can ask me questions.
Well, you'll have good staff to sit with you while this is being discussed. Right, Council O'Leary?
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 266. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 266 would require the state to notify eligible defendants of the presumptive life sentence that is available upon conviction of a third felony sex offense. The bill would prevent the court from imposing a presumptive life sentence for that offense unless the state has provided such notice, unless there was a finding of good cause by the court for such failure.
Okay, we have signed up for this John Hummel from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we also have Mr. Dugan signed up, and you will come next. You can join him if you like, just the two of you, one for, one against.
Chair Burris, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is John Hummel. I'm an attorney in Bend and a member of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm representing that organization today. Glad to be here with my district attorney, Mike Dugan.
good to have the Ben show here. Go ahead.
Thank you. Many less sophisticated defendants or defendants of lower intelligence will choose to represent themselves at trial. Before a judge will permit a defendant to represent themselves at trial, the judge will question the defendant to make sure that their waiver of counsel is knowing and intelligent. Now, in non-legal speak, knowing and intelligent means that the defendant understands the potential legal consequences of representing themselves. Now, at a minimum, when a defendant is facing a potential life sentence in prison, if they are convicted, the defendant should be informed that they are facing such a sentence. ask in this bill that the defendant be informed that the potential sentence, or in, as a matter of fact, the presumptive sentence, if they are convicted, will be life in prison. So we think it would be important that defendants who are contemplating representing themselves know that. Now, the bill is also important for defendants who do have attorneys, which in the vast majority of cases of this serious, at this seriousness level, they will have attorneys. But it's still important in those cases because this is just a fact. Defendants in criminal cases are often not very good historians when recounting their criminal record. Many times they're suffering from substance abuse. Far too often they're of low intelligence. And they often tell their defense counsel, you know, I had a misdemeanor sex conviction a few years back. And perhaps the records that are provided to the defense counsel only show one felony sex conviction. They don't show two. So the defendant is not eligible, you would think, at first blush, is not eligible for the life sentence. While the defense attorney and the defendant prepare for trial, and perhaps an issue comes up on whether an expert witness will be hired by the defense. And the defense attorney might say, you know, Jim, I think you should hire that expert witness. We need that expert witness. And the defendant might say, you know, I can't afford it. I can't afford an expert witness. I don't want to hire an expert witness. You know, I'm only facing X amount of time in prison if I lose. You know, I'm going to decide not to spend that money. And then the person is convicted, and then the prosecutor might notice a conviction from another state that they didn't have at the beginning. They didn't have a record of that conviction, and then they provide it to the defense counsel. And then the defendant is eligible for the life time sentence. And the defendant's probably saying, you know, if I had known that, I would have spent the money on the expert witness. Now, I want to be clear here. This is not a situation where the Oregon criminal defense attorneys are suggesting the prosecutor is hiding that conviction so the defendant doesn't hire the expert witness. That's not it at all. Oftentimes with out-of-state convictions, they're not known to the prosecutor at the start of the case. They're not known to the defense attorney. They become known down the road, perhaps right after conviction, but before sentencing. And if there are two prior felony sex convictions, the person receives a presumptive life sentence. In this bill, we just say there needs to be a deadline before trial to find out if there are these prior felony sex convictions. We propose 30 days before trial. And now, if you do find the second felony conviction 5 days before trial, this isn't a yippee, you know, technical defense for the defense attorney. You can't get life in prison now. Absolutely not. The prosecutor can say, Your Honor, we've found the second felony sex conviction. The defendant is now eligible for life in prison, and we would ask for a delay in the trial, and the judge will set the trial out at least 30 days, so now the defendant has the 30-day notice. So the Oregon criminal defense attorneys are not trying to create a get-out-of-jail-free card, not a technical legal defense. The purpose of this bill is to inform defendants that they're facing a presumptive life sentence so they can, one, decide and make a knowing and intelligent decision regarding whether or not to have counsel, and two, can make important decisions with their attorney if they do have counsel regarding legal strategy throughout the case. And I'm available for any questions.
Okay, you mentioned two scenarios here. One is where someone does not have counsel and one where they do. Don't you see it as the role of the defense attorney to go beyond what their client tells them when they have something obviously at stake? Do they have the ability to find out whether they have previous convictions separate from their from what they learned from their client?
Yeah, absolutely, it's the role of the defense attorney, and we always do try to do that. First thing you do is you ask your client what's your prior record, and they'll tell you. You never take that at face value because oftentimes they're not good historians for the reasons I stated. Then you ask the prosecutor to provide discovery, or the prosecutor's already done that, where they provide the criminal history printout from the Oregon State Police, and then often they'll do a nationwide search. But quite frequently you'll find when convictions are from other states and other jurisdictions, they're not known to the prosecutor right away. It sometimes takes time to get this information. And the person who can get it the quickest and the easiest is a prosecutor is going to have more ability to access those records. For the most part, defense attorneys do not have the ability to call up another state and get a printout of state records. So the prosecutor will provide that, and they always do. In Deschutes County, where I practice, I've never, ever had a situation where they're withholding those records. That's not the situation at all, but prosecutor doesn't have the records, isn't aware of it. The defense attorney asks their client. They say, yeah, it was a misdemeanor I had. I haven't had a felony. We ask the prosecutor to provide the records, and that's all we know. And then down the road, it's discovered that it was, in fact, a felony. And all we're saying at that point is postpone the trial 30 days.
But even if a prosecuting attorney didn't have Mr. Dugan's sterling character,
right,
there are pretty serious sanctions for withholding information, aren't there?
Absolutely. No way is this a bill where we're saying they're withholding it. They don't have it. That's what we're saying. They don't have the information. Trial's proceeding, and then it's discovered by the prosecutor, not hidden in a drawer. They find out from another jurisdiction that there is such an offense.
And then the other thing I wanted to find out from you is, do you have any kind of a sense of how many of the people in this category of, you know, these very serious crimes do choose to go to trial without representation?
Yeah, Mr. Dugan and I were speaking about that. I don't have a raw number for sure, and we could easily get that, I imagine. The state would keep records on that. But it's small. This would be in the under 5% range. I just don't have that number now.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do the courts in other non-sex life imprisonment cases have to notify that there's potential for life imprisonment? Like, I don't know what there are, but the other three strike cases, or would they be subject to this then too? I mean, not by this law, but are they already subject to it?
Senator Byrd, thank you for that question. That's no is the answer, but the two-part answer. One, maybe they should. We might look to do that. I think it makes good public policy sense. But second, crimes where the life in prison is an option that are not contingent on prior convictions are less of a concern, because the judge at arraignment does notify the maximum penalty for the crime. It's crimes where the maximum penalty is different depending on your prior criminal history where these snafus can develop. So, but that having been said, there are other crimes where the sentence is contingent on your prior convictions, and this requirement is not placed on those crimes. So that is an accurate distinction that you bring up.
Another question, I think it's already been answered to you, about you talking about the other state conviction, but would that be a reason if the trial has already started, and not 5 days before, not 24 hours before, but the trial has already started and the prosecution finds out that there is another sentence somewhere else in another state, would that trigger the sub B then that allows the court for good cause to go ahead and that's what I read it. They could still do a life imprisonment if the court can find good cause for why the notification wasn't made.
Well, as I read the bill, that it's two-part test. You have to find a good cause and then allow a delay, because oftentimes the delay is needed to do something different, perhaps to hire an expert witness. And I would think even after the trial started, the judge could, once this additional conviction is discovered, could postpone the trial for, you know, it says 30 days. The defendant could always waive the 30 and just ask for, you know, week postponement or however lesser time than 30 they're comfortable with. But I think the delay is important because the trial strategy could be different. You might need to hire an expert, or the defendant might choose to hire an expert witness, for example.
That it?
Mm-hmm.
Senator Pisanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Powell, I want to go through some scenarios. At arraignment, we have the judge that has to tell the defendant before they take the plea what the maximum is. Measure 11, they're going to say you potentially could receive this type of sentence.
Right.
Same thing with if someone is could be not a U.S. citizen, how that could impact them as to deportation. So if you had a situation where a person comes in and just pleads outright, DA's there, and they accept the plea, and it comes out at the time they set sentencing sometime in the future, then they do their work to find out what type of sentence they want to recommend, and they find out at that time. I mean, what happens in that scenario?
Well, in that scenario, if the judge told the defendant at the before taking the plea during the plea colloquy that the potential maximum sentence is life in prison, I think the intent of this bill would have been satisfied, and the waiver would have been knowing and intelligent, and I think that plea would stand. And in this bill, if the judge is the person that informs the defendant of the presumptive life sentence, and then the defendant goes to trial and represents himself and loses, the defendant's been informed. So I think they can rely on Senate Bill 266 to try to remove the conviction.
Okay. So would it be a better practice to have the court at the time of arraignment to go through these different litanies, that if you have a potential increased or enhanced penalty, that should be done at that time? I'm thinking in my situations when I are trying cases, I may not have all the information.
Sure.
I may actually ask for a CCH to be ran, mm-hmm. and then I ask dispatch to do more work in trying to find some stuff. We may be at a point where we don't know anything, and it may be even after a plea has occurred or a conviction and they set sentencing out, and we're going to prepare for sentencing that time. Of course, most prosecutors are going to want to know how many convictions this person has to use for impeachment purposes if they take the stand. But it just seems to me that there's many ways that you could get, or the state could find itself in a situation where it would not have that information, and then they could be penalized because they were not able to go forward because they didn't have the information at that particular time before a conviction actually comes down. So I'm wondering, and I know Mr. Dugan hasn't spoken yet, if this is really an issue, why aren't we having the judges in all of these scenarios going through at the time of arraignment? Do you have a potential of these enhanced penalties?
Senator Pozanski, that is an excellent idea, and I say that with complete sincerity. Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association would support such a requirement. This bill, quite frankly, I don't think it's the best drafted bill of all time, and I blame our organization for that. The concept I support fully. Putting the burden on the prosecutors to try to do this during the trial when stuff might be coming in late, that seems foolish. If the judge at arraignment just said, there's a potential penalty of a presumptive life sentence in all felony sex cases in this class, so there's a potential for you to do life in prison if certain other things are met, that would satisfy our organization. The intent is just to make sure that these defendants know that, and so they can make intelligent choices throughout the process.
One follow-up. How big of a problem do we really have here? In the sense of, has this been occurring that you've had members come to you or to the organization saying, we've had X number of cases where these people got caught up with this presumptive life sentence?
Thank you for that question, Senator. It's not a huge problem. It's one that we've had one member who explained a case situation to us where he had some concerns about this, and it probably wouldn't even warrant a bill if the result of the problem was someone got a speeding ticket that they shouldn't have gotten. But it's because the result of the problem is life in prison that even when it happens rarely, it's such a draconian result that we think a fix is appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Dugan, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have some written testimony that I'd like to submit. And also make a statement. I am Mike Dugan. I am the district attorney for Deschutes County. I'm past president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I am appearing here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We are opposed to the bill. ORS 137-719, which creates the presumptive sentence of life if you have three prior convictions of this, was created by the Legislative Session and Assembly in 2001. It was interesting to listen to Craig Prince's testimony earlier today about the sentencing guidelines, because that's exactly what the legislature did, was it created a presumptive sentence and put it on the guidelines at that level. There are questions that the District Attorney's Association has, not the least of which I think some have already been asked by the senators. Why is it the District Attorney's job to do this work of the defense attorney? How do you define the term the state? I think there was a recent Court of Appeals case that found a teacher to be a state employee, and therefore, I think the legislature is going to be dealing with that bill, or a bill to fix that. So who is the state? And at what stage is the state going to be at the point where they've completed this notification? I asked Mr. Hummel earlier today, well, what if the police officer during the interrogation or the questioning of the suspect said, well, you know, if you got three of these, you're going to prison for life. That's sufficient. He's a state agent. So we have that issue as well. Primarily, though, we think this is a defense attorney's job. As Mr. Hummel pointed out, there's one member of the OCDLA that has had questions about this, but I don't recall in my 27 years now as a prosecutor or a defense attorney. I was 4 years as a defense attorney. I've been DA now. This is my 19th year. I don't recall one of these cases that has come before our office where a defendant who is charged with a serious sex crime has waived his right to have a lawyer. And the way you waive your right to have a lawyer, the judge virtually has to tell them that they're handling nuclear bombs and they shouldn't do that. They almost have to talk them out of that. So I think that the real problem is non-existent. We don't think as district attorneys it's our responsibility to be advising the defendant of anything. In fact, I think there might be some ethical issues with regard to how much advice we give to a defendant. We don't prepare the plea petitions, and Senator Pozanski is familiar with those plea petitions. They have to set out what the potential charges are and what the potential penalty is, the maximums. And finally, I think I want to point out the effect of this bill, I think, would be to put this presumptive sentence under 137-719 into the Blakely category. If we have to plead and prove it, do we have to give notice of it? Do we have to prove it? Sentencing guideline rules already provide a method of notifying the defendant of what the charge of what the his criminal history is. It gives the defendant an opportunity to challenge those in writing, and there's a hearing process. We already have that all set out in the legislature. The defense attorney's claim that we have as a state representative, the DA, have access to the LADS, the Law Enforcement Data System computer, or the NCIC, the National Criminal Information Center. The legislature has provided that access to the public defender offices and criminal defense attorneys. They have their own ORO number where they can go to the state police, and they can have the state police run a criminal history for their defendant. And it doesn't cost them anything to do that. Just as the legislature provided the state police crime lab, forensic labs, to provide services to the criminal defense attorneys. And they don't do that often either. So we think this is an unnecessary bill. It puts a burden on the prosecutors that shouldn't be on our shoulders. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Pozanski.
Hi. Mike, thanks for being here. I guess, Mr. Dugan, I guess what I want to ask you in your capacity, because I've never handled a Measure 11 type cases. I mean, I would assume that the judges at that time when they're arraigning these people are giving them what the potential maximum sentence could be.
At arraignment, generally speaking, we know it's a Measure 11 case. It's pretty clear. There's 22 charges or crimes that you can commit with Major 11, and the judges, the defense attorney, prosecutors, we're pretty aware of those when we make those charging decisions. Mr. Hummel did point out correctly that sometimes the MCIC record or the ALEDS record doesn't come with the discovery at the right time. It may come later, but it's so rare that that happens. Both of us have access to that. And ORS 135-805, which is a discovery statute, require the state to give the defense attorney everything we have with regard to the prior criminal history, the knowledge that we have of the defendant's prior criminal history. If we don't know that he has more than one prior conviction or two prior convictions, we can't tell them that he has more.
Right. But I guess if I can follow up, it would be my understanding is the judge would have a duty in arraigning the individual, telling that individual this is the potential maximum you may have, and on Measure 11 they're going to say whatever that sentence could be, giving them the maximum before they're when they're arraigned, and if they're especially they're going to take a plea on that. If that's the case, is there a reason why we should not require the judges, if they're not already doing it, to cover this litany at the time that someone is arraigned? And then it seems like we're beyond that and would not have to worry about what their actual record is or what the NCIC might bring in at a later date.
Madam Chair and Senator Przanski, I'm not sure that at arraignment in every criminal case the judge is advising the defendant. I don't think it's required that the judge advise the defendant what the maximum penalty is at the arraignment. Certainly at the time that a plea is entered, they have to advise them, and it has to be contained in the plea petition.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you. We will close the hearing on, well, before we do, I think I'd certainly welcome discussion of maybe other approaches of this. This seems to not be quite right for dealing with the potential situation. I certainly agree that it's a serious thing that we don't want to have ever occur, where someone is not properly informed about their choices under the law. But I don't think it's quite here. But I welcome a discussion if you'd like to engage in one. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 266. And we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 273. Senate Bill 273 and 274 together. So, Council, would you like to give a summary?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 273 and 274 amend the same statute. It's the statute that provides for exemptions from the execution of civil judgments. 273 would increase the exemption for the debtor's home. It's currently at $25,000. It would increase it to $50,000 for a single debtor. For joint debtors, it would increase it from its current level of $33,000 to $75,000. And it increases the motor vehicle exemption for the debtor from the current level of $1,700 to it would be a new level of $3,000. Meanwhile, Senate Bill 274 affects the exemption that is in place right now that exempts the earned income tax credit, and counsel will correct me if I'm wrong, but it adds to that an additional exemption for the additional child tax credit, which is an additional credit available under the Internal Revenue Code.
What's he doing? Thank you very much. Justin Baxter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Baxter. I am the chair of the Oregon State Bar Consumer Law Section, and I appear in support of Senate Bill 273. In addition, for Senate Bill 274, I'll be here in the stead of Professor Richard Slotty, Dick Slotty, who is the past chair of our section and a member emeritus of our executive committee. Beginning with Senate Bill 273, this bill increases the homestead and vehicle exemptions on judgments and consequently on bankruptcy filings. The homestead exemption and the vehicle exemption were good policy over a decade ago, and they're good policy today. The only problem is that the exemption levels have not kept pace with the dramatic appreciation in home values and the rise in the prices of new and used vehicles. When a debtor has judgment against them, a valid judgment, then they're required by law to pay on that judgment, and that is the law. However, the exemptions recognize that in these specific cases, the homestead exemption, the vehicle exemption, and others, I've included a worksheet of other exemptions. These particular exemptions recognize that there are higher necessities that outweigh the value of a judgment. They recognize that a person should not lose their home because they couldn't pay a medical bill. They recognize, these exemptions recognize that a person should be able to get to work. They should keep their car so that they can go to work and be able to make good on the debt, be able to pay the debt. So what we've proposed here are what we believe are modest increases to reflect over a decade of appreciation and inflation in the market. Again, to reflect the increase in people's equity. Starting with the home, the major issue that we see is the appreciation in home values. A family that bought into a home perhaps a decade ago or 15 years ago may have bought in at a median level of $100,000 or $150,000, but just by virtue of the property sitting there gaining value, they may now have many thousands of dollars of equity in the home. Median home sale prices in Portland, two-bedroom houses within city limits, are ballpark around $200,000 to $250,000. So just by virtue of having the home and making their mortgage payments, they may have increased their equity. And the exemption recognizes that a person, again, should not lose their house, lose their investment in the roof over their heads over a medical bill that may be far less than the equity. By the same token, new and used car purchase prices have risen dramatically over the last 10 years. And this one, the policy is similar but slightly different and equally important. Again, the car typically is a consumer, a debtor's means of getting to work and generating income, and thereby being able to pay off these debts that they incur. So while it's important and valid policy for creditors and judgment holders to be able to recover on valid judgments, it is an equally important policy for families to be able to keep a roof over their heads and to be able to get to work. Turning to Senate Bill 274, to just sort of clarify, the last legislature, the last session, passed a bill, a law exempting the earned income credit. That was a tax credit that Congress had enacted. In 1998, Congress passed a similar tax credit called the Child Tax Credit. And it was basically a $1,000 credit for each child for taxpayers in a certain bracket and under certain circumstances. Originally, as enacted, that was just solely a credit against taxes. In 2001, Congress changed that to become a refund. If at first the $1,000 per child would be weighed against the tax liability, but then beyond that, and this law applies primarily to lower income families that have small tax liability. Beyond the initial $1,000 of tax liability after they offset the tax liability, a taxpayer can then recover a refund of whatever's left. And I don't pretend to be an expert in the mechanics of the law, but we have provided some documentation put out by Center on Budget and Policy Priorities at about page 10 of the written materials. There are some different scenarios that show what a working family with dependent children, how this tax credit can apply, and it can range from several hundred dollars back to a family up to several thousand, and as the family's income goes lowers, then they get a progressively larger tax refund. And moving to our bill, the policy behind it is similar as the first bill, and it's basically that Congress has created this tax credit to benefit working families, and the money should go towards helping those working families with children rather than paying off medical bills or other debts. That's my prepared testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Thank you very much. Do you happen to know when the last time these limits were looked at?
I believe the most recent changes became effective in July of 1993.
In 1993, because it's, you know, it's over 100%, and I'm talking about the Senate Bill 273 now. It's over 100% increase that you're proposing in this, which is as much as home prices have gone up. I'm not sure they've gone up that much. I kind of wish they had, but and I'm just wondering how you picked the numbers that you picked.
Madam Chair, it is substantial. We, our section, members of our section, did some research in trying to come up with these figures. What we saw nationwide is that there's no set number. Each state seems to be across the board, and some of the factors are whether states have other exemptions that are higher, whether they have aggregate wild cards or blanket exemptions. We tried to set ourselves in the middle, particularly around the western states, but we did note that in our research, some states are place a very high value on the homestead. For example, Florida and Texas have 100% exemption. Nobody's touching your house. And that's a very good policy, but we haven't gone quite that far.
Thank you. Senator Walker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Baxter, where does Oregon stand in terms of housing costs? And you talked about how housing has appreciated, but on the national scale, where do we stand in terms of being able affordable housing?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Walker. It's a good question, because the factors are both the cost of housing as well as the ability to buy, the economic situation and state economy. So trying to balance those two figures, anecdotally, housing in Oregon is more expensive as a percentage of the average income for the average home buyer in Oregon nationally. About the middle, if you just look at the numbers for buying a home. I think anticipating the other side's arguments, one difficulty or one issue that we would have to address is that housing costs in the Portland metro area are going to be very different than the housing costs in Coos Bay, for example. But across the board, you know, I think the sense of the section is that housing is expensive as a percentage of the average Oregonian's income, and it's on the rise. The housing market is tighter, or a seller's market, so to speak.
Thank you. Mr. Baxter, did Congress intend that a debtor, when they reorganize or file a liquidation plan under Chapter 7, did Congress intend for that debtor to have to move to an area where the housing costs were lower when they file such a bankruptcy?
I, Madam Chair and Senator Walker, I think absolutely not. In the bankruptcy code, the states have the option of setting these exemption levels, and Oregon has elected to run the bankruptcy exemptions at the same levels as the judgment exemptions. And in this case, the policy behind the federal bankruptcy code is this fresh start that we often hear about. And a consumer, an American, is entitled to a fresh start if they, you know, get in over the heads or circumstances create a situation where their income is eclipsed by their liabilities. And what's contemplated in the bankruptcy code is that there will be exemptions and that the debtor will be able to start anew. And I don't think that I see anywhere in the policy of the bankruptcy code that a person should have to step down, should have to relocate themselves or their families to cheaper, less expensive accommodations.
May I continue?
Please do.
Thank you. The higher education assistance organizations would disagree with you because sometimes I've seen them in bankruptcy court and they're like your worst nightmare of a bill collector. They want you to move. They want you to change jobs. They even go out of state so long as you can pay them back for their education loan. Now, that was just a little side comment on my own. So, Mr. Baxter, let me also ask you, when Congress said that debtors should have a fresh start, Congress did not intend for the debtor to have a fresh start with a lot of money, more money than a regular person on the street should have. In other words, bankruptcy should not be a windfall. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, absolutely. I agree, and that is, under the bankruptcy code, creditors have rights. There's a whole slew of hearings and motions and potential litigation where the creditors can assert their liens and their interests against debtors, against the petitioner's assets. At the same time, Congress explicitly recognized that there were going to be exemptions, that the same policies underlying the judgment exemptions that we're going to let, as a matter of policy, we're going to let consumer emerge from bankruptcy with the ability to put a roof over their family's head, to drive to work, to be able to begin to start that fresh start, that new life.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two more questions.
Two more.
If I might. Thank you. And the other issue is that bankruptcy is really a balancing test, because if the debtor isn't going to pay his or her bill, the creditor eats the cost. That creditor can be a collection agency. That creditor can be someone like you or I. We could owe a debtor. Loaned a debtor $1,000 to do something, and it's an unsecured loan, and so we're a creditor. I've seen many people who are unsecured creditors who $1,000 or even $500 is a lot of money to them. So you would agree that this is a balancing test, and particularly when we look at the auto exemption, that we're not talking about buying the debtor a new car here. We're talking about the debtor buying a vehicle that will get them to and from work and provide for their family in a safe environment. Is that true?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, absolutely. This is an increase to $3,000. We're not talking about a brand new Jaguar. This is enough money for a consumer to buy a modest used car to get themselves to work and pay their bills.
Okay, and I'm sure the final question is that you use medical bills a lot when you were talking about debtors, but debtors are debtors because sometimes they do very stupid things. They don't know how to manage their money. Financial literacy in this country is an all-time low. So, you know, there are the hardship cases. There are hardship discharges available to debtors under bankruptcy law. So, again, I want the committee to be aware that there's a balancing here. And we did last session pass the Earned Income Credit Bill. That was a bill I brought forward because that is truly for those debtors who are very, very low income. And I think that's what the child care credit is looking at. But we also have to balance that. So as we ask questions and get testimony here today, I want to remember the balancing act. And that is really my comment rather than a question. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I want to start with talking about that additional child tax credit. The way I read this, it's any monies that are traceable to a payment of the earned income tax credit or the additional child tax credit. So, I mean, under your scenarios, I'm just picking one here, you know, somebody, I don't know which one of the higher income ones that I found just wasn't through this. A person, they had two kids, $28,000, that's taxable income. I believe that is not just gross income, but taxable income. The total refund would be $1,410 in 1 year. The assume they stayed the same, it would be $1,410 refund again in the following year, and then again in the following year. So let's assume 3 years into this refundable or this additional child tax credit, they now have $4,200 that if they happen to have some money in the bank, they could say, well, all of that money is from my additional child tax credit, so none of that cash is touchable. Is that an accurate scenario?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, yes.
So this is a cumulative thing. It's not a single year's additional child tax credit. It builds up over 17 years potentially.
Yes, as I read the original LC language, it would accumulate. That's something certainly that that could be addressed and could be modified to address that point.
And just another question about that. I see the literature you handed out. I only went up to in the graph to $25,000 of income, but isn't in fact the child tax credit? It's we're up to $100,000, I think, of income. Doesn't it? I mean it does get lower, but isn't that the upper limit that people with up to $100,000 of income of children under the age of 17 are eligible for that tax credit?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't know the exact mechanics of the particular credit, but my understanding of the way it works is that as income gets progressively higher, rapidly this $1,000 credit per child gets eaten up by tax liability. So unless a family had 20 children, I think that they would see no appreciable refund as their income got up in the higher realms.
Okay.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Baxter is my constituent, so I'm glad you could come today.
Yeah.
Next we have, I think we'll take Jim Marquis from the Oregon Collectors Association.
Come on, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association today, and I brought up with me Cindy Robert, who is the new lobbyist for the National Association of Credit Managers, a position for which I am proud to say that I recommended her for.
His number, let me go.
I apologize for not mentioning your name, Cindy. I had a little trouble with the handwriting here.
I want to say that I agree with what Senator Walker said in regard to bankruptcy, that it is a balancing act, and I think nobody recognizes that more than I do, having lobbied these kinds of bills in this building for almost 30 years. My client, the Oregon Collectors Association, are opposed to both of these bills in a present form, but I want to say that one of the reasons that these numbers haven't moved much in the past few sessions has been, I believe, a lack of communication between creditor groups like the one I represent and the other members of the United Financial Lobby, the Bankers Association, credit unions, finance companies, all of whom belong to that organization. That organization is opposed to these bills, too. But there's been a lack of communication between we and the consumer folks about these bills, and the bills come in and we oppose them and they don't pass or whatever, and there's been little discussion, and we attempted this time to change that. I talked with the Oregon State Bar and Susan Gravy and others and agreed that I would sit down during the interim and talk to the consumer law folks, including Justin, about some kind of an increase, particularly in these two areas, because there had been no increase for 10 years. Justin said 93. I believe that these were changed in 95, but it's not a big issue, but I'll go back and check and make sure I'm right on that. I entered those conversations with the consumer section in an effort to try to come to some reasonable conclusion where we might agree to some reasonable increase in the auto exemption and in the homestead exemption. Needless to say, my client has a different philosophy about exemptions than the consumer law section or their clients. And that's not to say that either are unreasonable. It's just a different set of beliefs. And reasonable people disagree about these things. If you don't believe that, look at the 50 states and their exemption list. They're all over the map. And there is little correlation, I believe, between the cost of housing, for instance, in any particular state and the homestead exemption in that state. People just disagree. So it's been 10 years, and it may be time to raise these two. I think that the bills raise these two exemptions higher than they should. I don't think that if you looked at the CPI, for instance, on autos from 95, and applied that CPI in the Portland metropolitan area to the $1,700 auto exemption, you'd get to about $2,100 on an auto using the CPI. Now, you can argue if that's fair or not. I don't know if that's fair, but that's where you'd get to using the CPI. And, of course, that would be assuming that the $1,700 was fair 10 years ago. Now, I don't know if it was fair 10 years ago. I don't know if $2,100 is fair today. I don't know. I would have clients who would argue the $1,700 was too high 10 years ago. Justin would have clients who would say it was too low 10 years ago. So those are issues for you folks to sort out, I suppose, and that's probably why the citizens of Oregon pay you those big bucks they do. We believe that these increases are too much, and I've met with these folks, and we've tried to come to some resolution, and we haven't come to that resolution, and I'm not sure we'll ever agree completely, but perhaps we can continue the discussions, and we'll get someplace. With respect to Senate Bill 274, we're opposed to that. I don't understand the additional child tax credit. I don't understand it. I'm not a CPA, not a tax lawyer, and I don't understand it. But I'm willing to bet you that I'm not alone in this room in not understanding it. I don't believe anyone else in this room understands it. I don't believe the proponents of this bill understand it. And to say, well, it's a tax credit for working people, therefore it ought to be exempt, is not the test we ought to be using. As policymakers, we ought to have some other test than that, I hope, because under that test, all tax credits would be exempt. So I would just ask you to require of those who wish to change the law in this area and create a new exemption to provide you with a little better information than it is meant to help working people. I just don't think that's a good enough argument. And as Senator Walker, you know that last session we did not oppose your bill to add the earned income tax credit. And I went to my clients and said, Senator Walker wants to do this, and we didn't oppose it. But of course, every time we add one of these, then there's another one that comes behind it. Because we exempted the first one, we have to exempt the next one. And that's the problem my client has with these exemptions. And when we look at bankruptcy in this state or across the land, it is a balancing act. And the question is always, we want to provide people a fresh start. The question is, at what level will we allow them to start? And if they live in a $400,000 house and they've got a bunch of equity in it, that may be part of the reason that they filed bankruptcy in the first place. Most people who file bankruptcy do so because they were living above their means. Not all of them, and sometimes there are extraordinary circumstances that cause them to have financial problems through no fault of their own. But we have rampant financial illiteracy in this country. And frankly, people get themselves into trouble. And so sometimes it may be appropriate to ask those people to start at a little lower level than they're used to living at.
Thank you.
With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Sorry, I thought you were done. Questions from the committee?
Well, I'll wait until Ms. Robert.
Okay. Ms. Robert.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I work for the National Association of Credit Management, thanks to Jim. They are an organization that is 108 years old and offers collection services, credit reports, educational resources, and account management for businesses. I have to tell you, when I first came in here, this was really the first issue for NACM that I worked, and it's been 2 months. My history with them is 2 months. And I read the bill. And I read some testimony that was provided in advance for the bill, and I thought, how can we not be for this? How can we not, as compassionate human beings, be for the raising of these exemptions? Who am I working for? What am I doing? But then I sat there and I listened to it some more, and all of a sudden I realized, what I am doing is working for people who are willing to put money forward for other people and trust that they will pay it back. It's simple. You're supposed to pay back what you borrow. My mom taught me that. Pay back what you borrow. You heard here today from the proponents of this bill that people are entitled to a fresh start. People are not entitled. It's not life, liberty, and the pursuit of perfect credit history. You are not entitled to a fresh start. If you have to claim bankruptcy, and this is a last resort, bankruptcy is a last resort. There's plenty of financial programs that people can go through who have had those high health bills, who have had something totally unforeseen happen. Bankruptcy is an absolute last resort. And if you have to go through it, a fresh start is good. You're not entitled to it. It's good. And it's no different from when I graduated from college and I had earned a fresh start. But nobody gave me money for a house. Nobody gave me money for a car. I had to earn it all myself, and it made me stronger. I'm not sure how bankruptcy is any different than someone first getting out of school. They've made mistakes. There's plenty of things in our system that allow you to fix those mistakes. There's plenty of opportunities to fly straight. But increasing these exemptions isn't going to change how many people file for bankruptcy. If it did, if not raising these exemptions makes it so more people don't file for bankruptcy, well, amen. And I'll let Jim answer any questions.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pazanski.
I was going to ask Ms. Robert a question, but I guess I have to ask Mr. Marquis. My understanding on how these different exemptions actually work, let's say someone does have equity in a house, and under the current one, we're $25,000. If they had $75,000 in equity, they could be forced to sell that property, retain $25,000, mm-hmm. and then move forward in their life. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct, Madam Chair. Senator Pazanski, yes.
And so basically it is going to be a policy decision for us as a legislature to determine at what point do we think is a means of providing for that quote-unquote fresh start where they are able to
regroup and begin over, knowing that they're going to have something as a baseline if they're have equity in a piece of property. And so what I'm hearing is that your clients are saying, let's stop, let's look at what, if anything, needs to be adjusted at this point. Now, I've also heard, at least from Mr. Marquis, that there had been an attempt to work with the State Bar's Consumer Committee or Division, whatever it is. Is there a desire at this point for you to maybe see if there's some common ground, something as Senator Walker would say, something that we could balance out and maybe see if it's something that we should look at for this session?
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, I'm happy to try to continue those talks with those folks and try to reach some ground. And in fact, the United Financial Lobby asked me to do so, and I intend to do so. I simply didn't realize the bills were going to be scheduled this early. So,
we're a fast-moving committee, Mr. Mayor.
I know you are. I know.
Are there other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Ms. Robert, you and I will have to have a conversation later.
I know, I see in your eyes.
I think that's going to happen. Funny feeling.
Yes, it's a nice client you work for. All right, so the deal is that you entered into negotiations. Ms. Robert, you weren't involved in those. This was a process of negotiation. Am I correct, Mr. Marquis? This was supposed to be a process of negotiation.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I guess you could describe it as that.
All right. Well, it was supposed to be a process of negotiation, and what happened here, since we're talking about that, is that Mr. Marquis didn't like that opening amount. And so I think, Madam Chair, what would be helpful is I would be happy to head up a work group. I'm not sure when I'm going to find time in my schedule, but I'm going to do that. Because I think Mr. Marquis's client and Ms. Roberts' client have merit in what they say. But we also have to recognize that Congress did intend for debtors to have a fresh start. As much as your client thinks we should all pay our debts, we should, but people don't. And I see people milk the system. I work in bankruptcy court, have done so for 21 years. It happens. They milk the system, but Congress has made it very difficult for debtors to get away with that today because they've put the squeeze on judges to make sure that repeat filers, as we call them, people who file bankruptcy over and over again. Actually, if you come in with two bankruptcies, you have to come before the judge, and it is very, very difficult to get your case confirmed or to move forward. But Congress recognizes that debtors need a fresh start, and the cost of living has increased. So I don't think it's unreasonable, Madam Chair, that the consumer group has come in asking for an increase in these exemptions. Have they aimed too high? Yes. Can we negotiate? I believe so. And the child care credit is one that I want to look at. The earned income credit is based on your income. And that was the compelling argument for passing that in this legislative assembly. Senator Beyer asked a very good question a while ago, which I was not aware of, about the child care tax credit being given to people who make $100,000. If that's indeed true, I find that a little bit unfair that a high-income wage earner like that can get help paying child care costs when they don't really need it. So, Madam Chair, what I'm asking in this long-winded explanation is that you give me an opportunity to work with these folks in a work group setting. I wanted you all to hear the arguments about why it should be increased. And I think reasonable people, as we all are, can work together and come back before this committee later in the session.
I appreciate your volunteering to do that, Senator Walker, and I would like to suggest you get together with all the parties that are here, including Mr. Baxter. And I would like you to focus your attention on Senate Bill 273. I think 274 is a bit of a different discussion, and maybe you and I could have a sidebar conversation on that. But I think 273, there's consensus that there is there's something that needs to be done, and I think from what I'm hearing, I think it can be worked out. So I appreciate your volunteering to do that with no time.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the witnesses at the dais. They represent their clients well, and their clients are good people. They're in a business where they loan money to people, or they have to collect bills for other people, and that's their job, and that's an admirable job. But we also have consumers who do get in over their heads, and that really is a discussion for another day. Credit card companies really need to start paying attention to what they do by offering credit to people who can least afford it. And I hope you're listening out there, all you credit card companies. And I know you are.
We might want to send the
Madam Chair, let the record reflect. Cindy and I do not represent credit card companies.
Well, that's
and our
good.
Clients are much nicer than those higher ed people, too.
Yeah, the higher ed people are ruthless. And, Madam Chair, I do want to tell you that in my education committee, we will be addressing this issue of financial literacy because truly it is an issue that is out of control in this country. We are a country of financial illiterates, and this is why we've seen an increase in bankruptcy as well as the economy tubing as much as it has.
Senator Walker, does that mean we're going to see stuff in 48 print and 64 print? Bold.
Thank you very much. Before we close this here, Senator Byrd?
I just have a point of clarification on Senator 274. I know we're talking for Senator Walker's work group, apparently, but the additional child tax credit, I don't, it's not my understanding, that's for child care. That's not for daycare. That's anyone with a child under the age of 17.
Yeah, that's the political vote. That's for everyone to be voting in the national election the way that needed to vote.
Well, we're moving on about Senate Bill 274 for the time being, Senator Byrd. Before we close this hearing, we have Sybil Hebb in the audience, and to save time, I'm just wondering if you might just want to be part of this work group.
That would be wonderful.
Would that be good? You have testimony for the record?
I appreciate that, Chair Burdick. I have testimony, and I would love to be a part of the work group, so thank you.
Great, thank you. And for the record, that's Sybil Hebb, and she's from the Oregon Law Center, and she's submitting testimony for the record.
Oh, thank you.
So with that, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 273 and 274. And before my committee leaves, I have an announcement. Tomorrow we go to prison. And it should be a very stimulating trip. But if you want to go on the prison tour tomorrow, we're going to the Mill Creek Correctional Facility and the Oregon State Penitentiary, and there are several staffers sign up and myself, and if anyone or their staff wants to go, please tell Patsy this afternoon down in Judiciary Office, or you can call my office if you'd rather, and welcome you to come. It's really a great tour. I haven't done it for a few years, but it's very educational.
Madam Chair, if someone's done it before, I recommend everyone wear Levi's.
No.
Okay, excuse me. Senator Byrd raises a good point. No denim. No denim anywhere on your person. Otherwise, they won't let you in, and obviously...
No, that's not true. They will let you in.
They won't let you out. That's correct. They will not let you out. No cell phones, pagers. There's a whole list of things you can and can't do, which you should pick up if you sign up, and anyone's welcome. So.
And, Madam Chair, be forewarned that the multi-purpose room is not what you think a multi-purpose room is.
On that intriguing note, Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
Yes.
Yeah.